SBS, a world of difference. You're with NITV Radio, on mobile, online and on radio.
We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land NITV Radio broadcasts from, the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation and their elders past and present. We also acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes and clans we broadcast to, from the mountains to the plains, from the desert to the sea, from fresh water to salt water.
Yama, and welcome to NITV Radio. Coming up in your program this Monday, the 31st of July, well, July the 30th, which was yesterday, marked 15 years since a landmark High Court decision granted Sea Country legal rights to the Yolngu people of the Northern Territory. The court decision, as you'll hear, centered around 40 Yirrkala bark paintings from the saltwater collection, and this legal fight was just one small part of a much richer Indigenous history and relationship to the sea. Also on NITV Radio today, last week, more than 60 Indigenous men who served for Australia during the Korean War were identified by the Australian War Memorial, a move that marked 70 years after the Korean Armistice Agreement. In the program today, we also have a conversation with Jingalu, talking about Dog Tag to Be Human 2023, her artwork that's been shortlisted among the finalists for Australia's longest-running Indigenous Art Awards, the Natsias. All these stories and more coming to you after the latest news on NITV Radio. Bertrand Tungandami Ngaya. I am Bertrand Tungandami.
Australia Day 1972 saw the first Aboriginal embassy erected outside Parliament.
The native title legislation must be amended.
And they've walked this land so many times before anybody came.
I am sorry.
This bulletin, a call to action after public hearing into missing and murdered First Nations women and children. The Housing Australia Future Fund legislation to be reintroduced when Parliament resumes this week. And the First National Scorecard assessing deforestation across Australia released. Public hearing into missing and murdered First Nations women and children has finished with a list of Aboriginal women who have died in custody and a poignant reminder, say her name. Latoya Rule from the Jombana Institute for Indigenous Education and Research read out some of the names of Aboriginal women who have died in custody to the Senate inquiry in Sydney. They pointed out that a great number of those related to the people who have been killed while in custody used the hashtag #SayHerName as a call to action. Yesterday, July 30th, marked the 15th anniversary of a court case that gave sea rights to the Yolngu people who live on the northeastern Arnhem Land on the Northern Territory. The legal victory guaranteed Indigenous ownership of around 80% of the Northern Territory's coastline. The 2008 ruling ended a decade-long battle by the Yolngu people to have ownership of the intertidal zone around their lands. The move allowed traditional owners to make important decisions about fishing and commercial interests. Matt Paul, manager of Indigenous programs at the Australian National Maritime Museum, says the case was a significant extension of the land rights movement. He highlighted one historical precedent, the admission of traditional Indigenous artworks as legal evidence.
That was a really significant case in lots of sort of ways. The 80 bark paintings that were made as part of the saltwater bark painting collection, the community see those as legal documents more so than paintings. They were presented to the High Court of Australia, and the High Court of Australia actually recognised through these paintings and the patterns, the subject matter, that there was a deeper connection to that of the, which overruled terra nullius in a sense, or aqua nullius as it is.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese is set to reintroduce the Housing Australia Future Fund legislation to Parliament this week. A vote is expected in the lower house by October. It is the second time the bill will be introduced to Parliament, having failed to pass the Senate in June. The coalition ruled out its support for the bill from the outset, leaving the government to negotiate with the Greens and crossbench. Greens housing spokesperson Max Chandler-Mather told the ABC the proposed bill being reintroduced does not do enough to meet the need for social and affordable housing.
I think it's important to note that under Labor's current plan, the Housing Australia Future Fund, the housing crisis will get much, much worse for two reasons. One, the proposed bill doesn't even meet the increase in need for social and affordable housing, and it does nothing for renters, for the one-third of this country who rents. I should note that they're reintroducing the bill unchanged.
Legislation for an increase to the job seeker payment is also expected to be introduced as Parliament resumes this week. Social Services Minister Amanda Richworth has already announced the unemployment benefit will be lifted by $40 a fortnight starting in September. But for these changes to come into effect, Labor's safety net bill has to pass during this sitting fortnight. Cassandra Goldie from the Australian Council for Social Service says welfare groups are disappointed by the level of the increase, as it's still well below what was recommended by the government's own Economic Inclusion Advisory Committee.
Every dollar's welcome, but this won't get us where we need to be. JobSeeker will still be a poverty payment despite this increase coming through in September.
Missing Persons Week has begun in an effort to raise awareness of long-term missing persons and shed light on the trauma experienced by those loved ones who are left behind. The feelings of hope and hopelessness felt by the loved ones of those missing is known as ambiguous loss and is considered to be one of the most traumatic types of grief, and yet there are very few support services available. To bridge the gap, the MIST Foundation has now launched a free online masterclass to help police, social workers and families navigate the grief. Dr. Sarah Wayland, an associate professor at the University of New England, has created and hosted the masterclass.
The challenge when someone is missing is that there's no possibility of sitting with or learning to accept that the loss has occurred. So that loss remains in that really uncertain, traumatic space for longer periods of time.
The First National Scorecard assessing deforestation across Australia, Australian states and territories has been released. The scorecard, issued by the Worldwide Fund for Nature Australia, assesses which states are leading the way in protecting and restoring trees and which states are lagging behind. New South Wales and Queensland have both been given the status of very poor on the scorecard, securing a position as Australia's worst clearers of trees. Dr. Stuart Blanche is a conservation scientist with WWF Australia. He says the scorecard brings attention to the positive work being done by some states and territories, as well as the urgent need for improvement in some locations if Australia is to reach set targets.
It shows a bag of mixed results. No government gets good, or let alone very good, and we have a couple at very poor. So we all have a long way to go, particularly if we're going to achieve the Australian government's commitment to halt and reverse forest loss and land degradation by 2030.
The federal government is reassuring Indonesian authorities that Australian animal exports are free from the deadly lumpy skin disease. Indonesia has paused exports from four Australian facilities, pending further testing of animals after a small number of exported cattle were detected with the disease. But Federal Agriculture Minister Murray Watt says Australia remains free of the disease. The federal government has briefed state and territory ministers, met with Australia's ambassador to Indonesia and other departmental officers, and began rapid diagnostic testing of cattle across northern Australia. An air safety investigation team has arrived in Queensland to examine the crash of an Australian Army helicopter during Exercise Talisman Sabah. There are grave fears for the lives of the crewmen, who have now been identified as Captain Daniel Lyon, Lieutenant Maxwell Nugent, Warrant Officer Class 2 Joseph Laycock, and Corporal Alexander Nags. They were on board the Taipan helicopter when it crashed in water near Queensland's Lindeman Island on Friday. Minister for the Environment and Water Tanya Plibersek told Sky News while a thorough investigation into what went wrong will take place, the first priority is on finding those still missing.
Our first focus is on finding the four missing personnel and on supporting their families. Of course, the next very important question is what's gone wrong here? What's gone wrong mechanically? Of course, the investigation has to be thorough and it has to be complete. We need answers.
Australia has resumed its place in an international military training exercise following the Army helicopter crash in Queensland, feared to have claimed the lives of its four crew members. Thales Mansaba Exercise Director Brigadier Damien Hill says he temporarily paused the exercises over the weekend to allow personnel to contact family in the wake of the crash, but drills have now recommenced in the Northern Territory and Western Australia. Meanwhile, Defence Minister Richard Marles and his United States counterpart Lloyd Austin have met with soldiers from the multiple countries participating in the war games. Speaking in Townsville, Defence Secretary Austin says the 2 weeks of integrated training speaks to the country's united vision for the region.
We will continue to stand by our allies. This exercise helps us strengthen our unbreakable alliance and our vision for that free and open Indo-Pacific. I'm proud, really proud, that we have 13 countries participating in this year's exercise who share that common vision.
At least 42 people have been killed and more than 130 injured in a bomb attack at a political rally in Pakistan's northwest. The blast took place at a gathering of the conservative Jamiat Ulema Islam Fazi party, known for its links to hardline political Islam in the area of Bajor, which borders Afghanistan. A shooting in Michigan has wounded 5 people, including 2 who are in a critical condition. The Lansing Police Department says officers responded to reports of a shooting early Sunday morning. The 5 victims have been transported to a hospital by the Lansing Fire Department. Local police say several people were detained and officers found multiple firearms at the scene. And to sport, Australian tennis warrior Alexei Popirin has overcome severe leg cramping to outlast triple Grand Slam champion Stan Wawrinka in an epic clay court encounter to claim his second ATP Tour 250 title. Popirin rallied from a set down and had to draw on all reserves in the decider to defeat Wawrinka 6-7, 6-3, 6-4 in a Croatian Open final in Umag that stretched past 2.5 hours. The 23-year-old struggled to move and was forced to go for a broke at every opportunity to shorten rallies in Sunday night's humid conditions. But the former French Open junior champion came up trumps to join an illustrious group of names, including newly crowned Wimbledon champion and world number one Carlos Alcaraz, on the tournament's honor roll. And now having a look at the weather around the country. Broome, sunny 26, Perth, partly cloudy 20, Adelaide, possible shower 16, Melbourne, partly cloudy 17, Hobart, showers and windy 30 degrees, Albury, Wodonga, mostly sunny 12, Canberra, cloud clearing 16 degrees, Wollongong, sunny 22, Sydney, also sunny 22, Newcastle, similar conditions, Brisbane, sunny 27, Townsville, mostly sunny 26, Cairns, a shower 227, Alice Springs, partly cloudy 24, Darwin, sunny 33, and the Torres Strait Islands, a mostly cloudy day, at a top of 29 degrees. And that is NITV Radio News.
NITV Radio, Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 1 p.m. or anytime online.
I am Bertrand Tungandame and you're listening to NITV Radio, coming to you from Nam on the Kulin Nation this Monday afternoon. Now coming up next in your program, well, last week more than 60 Indigenous men who served for Australia during the Korean War were identified by the Australian War Memorial. And this was to mark 70 years after the Korean Armistice Agreement. In the program today, we also have a conversation with Jingalu talking about Dog Tag to Be Human 2023, her artwork that's been shortlisted among the finalists for Australia's longest-running Indigenous Art Awards, the Natsias. But first, let's explore a landmark High Court decision 15 years ago, granting Sea Country legal rights to the Yolngu people of the Northern Territory. This legal fight was just one small part of a much richer Indigenous history and relationship to the sea. The 30th of July, which was just yesterday, marked the 15th anniversary of a court case that gave sea rights to the Yolngu people. The win guaranteed Aboriginal people ownership of around 80% of the Northern Territory's coastline, a ruling that included precedence over any commercial interests or fishing. And a series of back paintings were at the centre of the ruling. Piki Giacomelos reports.
It's been 15 years since a landmark High Court decision granted Sea Country legal rights to the Yolngu people of northeast Arnhem Land in the Northern Territory. The ruling, which gave traditional sea rights over coastal waters, set a precedent, with a series of bark paintings playing an important role in the High Court's recognition of the Yolngu's connection to the coastal waters. Matt Pohl is the manager of Indigenous programs at the Australian National Maritime Museum, which is also marking the anniversary. He says the 2008 sea rights case was probably one of the most significant extensions of the land rights movement in Australian history.
The recognition of the Yolngu people's territorial rights over their seas and coastlines off Blue Mud Bay is a recognition of the pre-existing connection to country that has been ancestrally connected to the Yolngu people in that region. And it was a really significant case in lots of sort of ways. The 80 bark paintings that were made as part of the saltwater bark painting collection, the community see those as legal documents more so than paintings. They were presented to the High Court of Australia, and the High Court of Australia actually recognised through these paintings and the patterns, the subject matter, that there was a deeper connection to that of the, which overruled Terra Nullius in a sense, or Aqua Nullius as it is.
The ruling ended a decade-long battle by the Yolngu to have ownership of the intertidal zone around their lands recognised. The ruling meant that around 80% of the Northern Territory's coastline was now under Aboriginal ownership, meaning that traditional owners could make important decisions about fishing and commercial interests. But it wasn't the first legal fight for native title to sea in the Northern Territory. The movement for sea rights dates back to the 1970s. This was when the Woodward Royal Commission into Aboriginal Land Rights noted that questions about land rights also extended out to sea. In his final report, released in 1973, Justice Woodward recommended that a buffer zone of up to 2 kilometres out to sea should be closed to non-Indigenous people to protect Aboriginal land. Marcus Barber is an environmental anthropologist in land and water at the CSIRO and has helped map waterways for sea rights.
The history of the sea rights, it goes back to the creation of the Land Rights Act in the 70s, that the Yolngu were integral in stimulating non-Indigenous society the creation of that act to recognise their rights. At the time, there was discussion about the fact that Yolngu understandings of their country go into the sea, and there was a very limited form of that that was able to be recognised in the Land Rights Act, but it was insufficient for a whole range of reasons.
Integral to the 2008 ruling were 80 bark paintings by 40 artists. The Maritime Museum's Matt Pohl explains the paintings were spread across 15 different clan groupings, which stretched all the way from Blue Mud Bay to Yirrkala and across to Arnhem Bay. He says the paintings are a living ancestral connection, highlighting the importance of the sea in people's lives.
Not surprisingly, there's ancestral stories of creation depicted in a lot of these paintings, but there's also people's personal totemic affiliations to many of those sea life as well, and many of the responsibilities that people have. I mean, the first paintings are connected to the origin of the whole story of the bark paintings. There was a legal fisherman who for several hundred years had been desecrating these waters. What sparked the case was the desecration of Barrow, the ancestral crocodile, and one of the Merriwillie family members who found the crocodile, which had been desecrated. It just sparked this this conversation, which led all the way up to the High Court case.
Matt Pohl says the artworks have acted as a type of template, a chain of stories that have been used for self-expression and as a protest document. Jambawa Marawili is an Aboriginal artist whose work has played an essential part in the recognition of sea rights.
Art's painting, it is a document that, from what I say, it was document from our ancestral bin to our grandfather, to our father, and to us. This is the story about our sea.
The first legal fight for native title to sea country also occurred in the Northern Territory, with the people of Croker Island having native title recognised to the seas surrounding their island in 2001. There have now been a number of successful native title claims to sea country. James Holman is a director of the Joglupanyu Aboriginal Corporation, which is also involved in marking the anniversary of the 2008 ruling this week in the small community of Bunyala. He hopes the anniversary will raise more awareness about sea rights.
And I think it's important to understand that country means land and sea. Waters flow through the land into the sea, back into the clouds, back into the land, and that cycle doesn't end. And it's something that is a part of all the decision-making, planning, the vision and the story of what is happening.
The bark paintings have been on display at the Australian National Maritime Museum in Sydney on and off for a number of years. Matt Pohl says they are extraordinary in their detail, using artistic production to tell complex stories.
When the artists talk about patterns coming from the land or from song that comes from the sound of water or even dance moves that comes from the wind blowing through the trees, there's this way that the land and the sea speaks through artistic production. And in many ways, that's why these paintings sort of write themselves in a sense. The living people who they're connected to are just custodians of temporary parts of that story, which is passed on intergenerationally through, you know, families since time began until the end.
Peggy Giacomelos, SBS News.
Visit sbs.com.au/NITV Radio.
More than 60 First Nations troops who served in the Korean War have been officially recognised, coinciding with the anniversary of the end to fighting in the conflict. Experts say it's a major step to honouring the sacrifices of First Nations veterans and recording their contributions. Kiara Haynes has this report.
On the 27th of July 1953, the Korean War ended. At least 60 First Nations soldiers are known to have served in the military during the conflict, and they're now being officially recognised by the Australian War Memorial some 70 years later. Garth O'Connell is the memorial's military curator.
The issue of their Aboriginality of the servicemen in the 1950s is very clear cut. It wasn't discussed, it wasn't needed, it wasn't asked for by the Defence Department. Who were part of the enlistment process. It wasn't until the mid-1990s that Defence even started to ask that question, which many people now recognise in any paperwork from the federal government. Just tick the box, are you Aboriginal and or Torres Strait Islander?
65 Indigenous men's names will be published as part of the memorial's ongoing research to recognise all Indigenous servicemen and women. Garth O'Connell has worked alongside First Nations historian Michael Bell to unearth their identities and stories. He says each story paints a vivid and often harrowing picture of what life was like for an Indigenous soldier before, during and after the war.
Ironically, military service for Aboriginal servicemen was a more level playing field socially for them during the conflicts. After they returned from these conflicts, that was when they then re-experienced forms of cultural like biases against their Aboriginality. And so that's why these men often just served as what we call a green skin army. Regardless of whether you're Asian, Australian, Aboriginal, white, whatever, in the service, pretty much that issue of their ethnicity or their background didn't mean anything. So for these men, it was not really an issue. It was only after they returned to Australia.
Mr. O'Connell says the research into the Indigenous veterans has been a collaboration with the soldiers' families, part of a painstaking process to confirm who they are.
We have identified these men over the years through a combination of factors. It can come from non-Indigenous servicemen who served alongside said Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander servicemen, but the most common one is from families or from the veterans themselves. And then they've given us their service details, we've looked it up, and then we've confirmed with local land councils and communities to confirm who said person is, and yep, it's all been confirmed.
Captain Reginald Saunders is one of the veterans being recognised by the Australian War Memorial. The captain was the first Indigenous soldier to reach the rank of officer in the Australian Army in 1945. Daughter Glenda Humes says he would have been so proud that other First Nations men he served alongside are now being recognised.
We've had so many Aboriginal men and women serve in nearly every conflict that this country has had, but they get very little recognition. You might get recognition on the battlefield, but that recognition off the battlefield is very, very rare. I mean, when my father come back from both the Second World War and Korea, there were just menial jobs around the country available for him. It wasn't until the 67 referendum again that he got a job with the Commonwealth Government working specifically for our mob.
More and more First Nations families are now contacting the War Memorial about relatives who fought overseas. Ms. Hume says their coming forward helps to paint a clear picture of Indigenous service and sacrifice during times of war.
When you know how Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people served this country during war, I'm not surprised. I'm surprised that there's probably not a few more that may come out of the woodwork. And I would certainly encourage family members, if they know that their uncle or grandfather or cousin served, let us know. Let the memorial know about that, because I think it's important that we record their service.
Kira Hain, SBS News.
Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
We must now go to a break, but stay with us, because when we come back, we have a yarn with one of the finalists in Australia's longest-running Indigenous Art Awards. Stay tuned.
Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
Time to talk about the NATIAS, the National Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander Art Awards, the longest running and most prestigious Indigenous Art Awards. I'm glad to say one of the finalists in this year's awards, Jingaloo, is joining us on NITV Radio to talk about her entry in the awards, Dog-Tag to be Human. Welcome to NITV Radio, Jingaloo.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Dog Tag to be Human. This is a title that can be for someone who hasn't seen the artwork or heard about your work. This is a Dog Tag to be Human, challenging and confronting a bit.
Just basically a look back into our history. It was called an exemption certificate, but it was known as a dog tag or other things from people.
It's based on your grandfather's history when actually in Australia, mm-hmm. for First Nations people, Indigenous people to be able to move freely in the country, they had to fulfill some requirements, including wearing this tag that gave them the possibility to be able to move around. This is why I said it's confronting and disturbing a lot, living through this kind of reality.
But this is what our history was, and a lot of people don't know about it, and wasn't that long ago this was going on, and, I mean, it wasn't to actually get one of these exemptions. You had to forget about your culture and your language and your family, your kin, everything you were about. Like I said, you had to have that ticket on you the whole time, and at any time it could be taken off you, so... But it was basically just to have, freedoms to go places and go everywhere. Because basically you You weren't a free person.
You weren't a human being. They're just treating you like And besides this being your grandfather's story, which is quite confronting already in itself, what prompted you to revisit this reality in your artwork?
I don't think a lot of people understand why we are the way we are, and the hurt that has happened, and the hurt that's passed down. And you know, I used to sit as a child and listen to my grandfather telling me stories and that, and I can hear the sadness and also the anger, and I heard all of that, and I'm lucky enough now to be able to speak about it and tell the story, so I sort of would hope that he was proud of me for, you know, speaking the truth, sort of, you know.
Yeah, and this is something that myself, most Australians wouldn't know about this reality, because this is part of the national history that is kind of swept under the carpet.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's just not talked. Well, it was a harsh part of our history, so it's not really talked about. But we have to acknowledge all of everything that sort of went on to move forward, you know.
And tell us how you bring this sad history, sad past of your people and this country into your artwork. Describe to us the artwork you entered. What is it?
I did a portrait of my grandfather, and it's all like his documentation, the photo that, because you just have to have your little two photos, but you had to have your negative. And back then, you know, cameras weren't around everywhere, which I know sounds silly today, but yeah, it was hard to get your hand on a camera, you know. That had to be sent down, and it's his photo from that, and just his exemption details. And so I've done a portrait of him, and at the back is like our sort of like Indigenous artwork. And then that's saying like the culture is behind it, and then I've got hands on it, which is like a white handprint, white colour, and it's just saying, you know, that we weren't allowed to hold our, you know, have our culture or anything like that, so, or our family, like we were, as much as we were allowed to get this exemption and everything, we still, you know, you got it to get free, but you weren't really free, That's what the painting, but yeah, it's just basically showing people what, and it wasn't too long ago, you know, that our people went through this, and this is still in people's, you know, it's in their memories, it's in their hearts, and, you know, people still cry over it. And
looking at the photograph that I saw of it, it looks like white hands actually soiling First Nations artwork.
Keeping us down, you know, you had to give up your knowledge, give up everything. So yeah, keeping us down. So.
And how big is it?
No, it's just under a metre, 91 centimetres.
And it's in a portrait format, actually, which is just like a passport photo in another passport photograph format.
Yeah. From way back in the 40s. The 40s it was.
And how did you get hold of your grandfather's photograph? You said it's very hard. These are archival and historic documents. Was it in his possession and he passed it on to you, or how did you get hold of it?
We actually had to sort of like go into the archives. So, because my mum and all of her sisters and my uncles are all taken it when they were little. But all my uncles were lucky because there was no room in the Sydney boys' home. So they were sent back up. But the girls weren't so lucky. And one of my aunties was able to get all the, Annie Wendy, so she's still out there. But she went and got all of our documentation because she was allowed to, you know, look for it all. And, yeah, that's where it came from. So, but, yeah, it's in the archives. They're really hard to get.
Accessing the archives itself is just like an obstacle course. It's not an easy thing.
Mm-hmm. No, no. You've got to go to the place too. So, you know, you've got to travel for it.
Now, before I let you go, any final thoughts or something we may have missed that you must absolutely bring to the attention of our listeners?
To be a finalist in the 40th, it's an amazing, like I never thought ever I'd get there. So, like, it's like the pinnacle of the art awards, you know, in Australia and stuff. So, it's a huge honour, and I'm so grateful to be amongst it all, and I'm looking forward to seeing all the other artworks and
Jingalu, congratulations for being a finalist, and thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us on NITV Radio today. It's been a really great pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
Your community, your conversation. NITV Radio.
For the break, you had a conversation with Jingalu, who is just one of 63 finalists in this year's 2023 Telstra National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Awards, Art Awards. It's Australia's richest art awards, presented by the Museum and Art Gallery of the Northern Territory and Telstra. Winners for this year's awards will be announced on the 11th of August 2023 at 6:30 p.m. in Sydney, and the exhibition will formally open on the 12th of August at the Museum and Art Gallery of the Northern Territory. In our upcoming programs, we'll bring you more conversations with other finalists. We must now step aside for a short break. When we come back, Mitch Tambo presents his latest single, Yugal Eulogy.
NITV Radio, Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 1 p.m. or anytime online.
Welcome back. Now, a couple of months ago, Mitch Tambo released a new high energy single, Yugal Eulogy. I took the opportunity to catch up with him, and as you'll hear, the song Yugal Eulogy transcends language barriers and is highly empowering.
Yugal Eulogy, which means song dance, and it's just all about coming together with your community, your loved ones, your village, if you like, being out under the open night sky and just letting go of all the weight of the world and just getting set free in celebration. But the posing question being, when the sun rises tomorrow, will you walk in that new freedom? Will you walk having let go of everything? Or will you carry it all back into your future? And that's what it's really about. So I'm really blessed to have it out. Really pumped that Fox Footy took it on board for Indigenous Round, and that we got to perform it for the opening too up there in Suncorp Stadium, and got to do halftime for Sydney Swans versus Carlton. It's been an incredible release, and just really blessed to have it out, to be honest, brother.
Yeah, Yugal Eulogy. Can you tell us a little bit more about the choice of this title? It's in your language, Gamilaroi language, as usual. Tell us a little bit more about your choice of this title.
Yeah, so Yugal Eulogy means song dance, and I think it just goes without saying, you know, the power in movement, the power in song. The healing that comes within music and dance and that kind of movement. And also, you know, we all have a song that is a soundtrack of our life, or we've got many of songs that, you know, take us back to certain memories and things. But this in particular is about the power in song and dance in terms of celebration and in terms of letting go and being set free.
Yeah, it's already, you know, setting new records with downloads and being streamed all over the country. Were you expecting that it would be picked up for the Indigenous Round?
Oh, look, there's never any expectation. You always just put a song out and you're kind of hoping for the best, you know, and it's all about, I think, not getting caught up in doing what you think people might like, and all about, you know, just creating and doing what got you to where you are in the first place. And sometimes that can be really hard, but, you know, the key is just to try and create and have fun and put something out you really love and believe in, and the hope that others will love it. You know, I think when you get caught up in trying to do something you think people will like is where you can kind of start to fall off what makes you unique, if that makes sense. And so, you know, with this song, we just did it. It's something that just really loved and I really believed in, and just really put it out in the hope that people would feel the spirit of the track, I suppose.
Yeah. And he said that this song, which is self-penned, you wrote it yourself and produced it, it transcends language barriers.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a song that is quite cinematic. It's anthemic. It's a really big sound. Like, if you've got a great sound system, I think you're going to love it because it's, there's so much happening in the production. It's got a really catchy hook and, you know, easy, I think, for people to sing along to and that kind of thing. And I think we've done it in a way where, you know, obviously knowing that people can't understand, but where it just feels really empowering, the music.
Yeah.
And I think I've been able to keep really integral to who I am as an artist in terms of the way that I'm singing it and the way that I'm putting it out there. I wanted it to feel almost like my older stuff meets my new stuff, where you can feel that sort of authenticity and also feel where I've come from and where I'm going, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Now, I know you're very busy today with interviews and other commitments. Just a closing word for our listeners.
Yeah, look, I mean, anyone out there listening, I just really appreciate your support. I'm just really humbled by it, and I just thank you for taking on, you know, something different and embracing it and making it a part of your catalogue and a part of your journey. And so anyone out there that's on the fence about putting something out there or doing something, my advice is just do it. Dare to be you. Dare to be your beautifully unique self. And, you know, let's just keep creating a world where we don't have to sacrifice who we are and we can just be authentically ourselves, and that can be celebrated and acknowledged and just embraced. I think that would be such a beautiful thing. And, you know, massive shout out to you, brother, because you've supported me from day one. And I just want to thank you so much from the bottom of my heart, because every release that I've ever put out, you've always supported it, always gave me the platform to jump on your incredible show and have a chat with you about that. And I just want to thank you so much for, you know, being on my journey and supporting my music. It really means the world. And although I'm flat out today with other interviews, I just want, you know, to make a point of just really honouring your show and all.
And that was a conversation with Mitch Tambo when he had a couple of months ago when he released his latest single, Yugal Yulugi. And that's all we have on NITV Radio this Friday afternoon. This Monday afternoon, actually, Monday, July 31st, NITV Radio will be back on Wednesday with more stories from right across the country. Bertrand Tungendamige, thanking you for your company this Monday afternoon. Till next time, bye for now. Yalu.